with Jaymon G. On the Fly is on the air.
And yes, we are. We are down at Ultralights, down on the farm. Hey, Steve, what row is this?
What row? This is row B in Ultralight parking.
I mean, I don't mean this row, but out there, what row would that be equivalent to in vintage parking? Do you know?
That's in the 70s, I believe.
70s. So, folks, you head south, and if you're cruising by all the airplanes, there's a whole section of Cessna 195s right out here in front of Ultralights. When you get to those 195s, you know you're there. You make a right, and you head on over to the Ultralight area, the Ultralight barn. It's very hospitable down here. There's all kinds of EAA stuff to buy. There's a gift shop. There's restaurants with food, beverages, and a whole bunch of friendly people that like to fly little ultralight airplanes. Artie Trost, you are one of them. Welcome. Hello.
Hi.
So, Artie, you are an ultralight pilot.
Technically, I'm now flying what's called an experimental light sport, but when you look at it, you'd say that's an ultralight. It's just a little heavier, flies a little faster, carries a little more gas than is legal under the ultralight regulations.
Excellent. Let's talk about that. You bring up a good point. What is the difference between a Part 103 qualified ultralight and sport ultralight?
As soon as you go above the legal limits for an ultralight, Part 103, such as more than 5 gallons of gas, such as being a two-seater instead of a single-seater, such as exceeding 63 miles an hour in straight and level flight. As soon as you exceed, as soon as you exceed a weight, empty weight of 254 pounds, then you technically are no longer an ultralight. Then you fall under light sport rules.
Right, and that changed, 6 years ago now? Is that right?
Yeah.
6 years ago.
Right.
So now there's a requirement. Once you get over those limits, you have to go take a written exam for a light sport pilot, get signed off by an instructor, and do all that stuff that you don't have to do with a Part 103 ultralight.
That's correct. And for those of us who were flying under Part 103, we were able to, we didn't have quite as many requirements to go through, but still had to take a written, still had to take a check ride.
Okay, tell us a little bit about what that process entails. Really, that's all over with now, right? That was, or is it still grandfathered?
No, you can't grandfather in since 2010 was the last time, January of 2010, that you could grandfather in.
Artie, what type of ultralight do you fly?
I have two ultralight types. I want to be clear, it's an experimental light sport. So, and one is a Maxair Drifter, which is a boom tube like a telephone pole with a plastic molded seat and wings and a propeller, and I flew that from Oregon to Sun and Fun in Florida 2 years ago, 7,500 miles round trip, and it took me 7 weeks. And this year,
wow,
I brought to Oshkosh a Talon, which is a grandson of the Drifter, flies slightly faster, and it took us 8 days to get here, and we flew 2,100 miles.
Wow. That's impressive. Now, do you do that as a group?
Well, I'm always looking for people that like to fly long distances. Not many folks like to do it. So I came in with two other pilots, one in a RANS and one in a Titan Tornado, both of whom are experimental light sport.
And where did you leave? Where did you depart?
Where did we leave from?
Yeah.
From Sandy, Oregon, which is just outside of Portland.
Okay. Wow. What was the route you took to Oshkosh?
We came across eastern Oregon and then followed the Snake River across Idaho, zipped up into Kemmerer, Wyoming to cross the Rockies, and then followed I-80 through Rock Springs, Rawlins, Laramie, Cheyenne. And then once we hit Nebraska with its flat fields and South Dakota, we pretty much left the highways and just did a beeline for Oshkosh.
You know, that Rock Springs area, that's pretty high and windy.
Yes.
what is the service ceiling on an ultralight like yours?
Well, it's interesting. Rock Springs is at 7,400 feet field elevation, and we had some pretty severe density altitude. I didn't have much problem. I was up at 10,500 feet, and the density altitude was about 12.5. The RANS had some difficulty, and so we had some short days because of that severe problem.
Now, are you a Rotax engine?
Yes, I am. I'm running a Rotax Greyhead 582.
And the RANS, what was it running?
An HKS.
Okay. Do those have auto-compensating carburetors? Is that how they...
I believe the HKS does. I know mine does not.
Okay, so you have to lean your mixture at those altitudes.
I had to change my jets on the ground. I can't do anything in the air except fly. So I had to change my main jets and my jet needle, the clip in my jet needle, to deal with the higher altitudes.
So do you do that then when you land at Rock Springs in order to take back off? You do a jet exchange?
No, I noticed was that I was using a lot of fuel and my EGTs were going high. When I started noticing that was when, and I'm trying to remember exactly, I think it was actually when we first got into Kemmerer is when I did that.
Okay. So not only are you a light sport pilot, but one of the really cool things about light sport is the fact that you can do so much of the maintenance yourself.
That's correct.
Now, is yours a kit-built or a factory-built aircraft?
Kit-built.
So if you build a kit aircraft, then you are actually qualified to maintain it, correct?
Well, actually, I have not built either. I've had three ultralights I've not built, or ultralight types. I've never built any of them. So for light, under the experimental light sport, you can take a two-day class. It's a 16-hour class. And that gives you the certification, I guess you'd say, to be able to maintain your own aircraft. If you build it yourself, you automatically have that right.
Okay. Now, is it Lockwood down in Florida that's the big supporters of the Rotax engine?
Lockwood, yes. Lockwood Aviation is Supply.
And don't they have a plethora of courses available for people who want to overhaul and maintain their own Rotax engines?
There's a number of places that do that. Lockwood is certainly considered one of the most well-known and does probably the most. The Rainbow Aviation out in California, also Brian and Carol Carpenter, also provide
very nice
training.
Folks. I know. Yes. Very nice folks.
Yes, and they also provide that kind of training. And I know there's other people. Those are the ones I'm just familiar with. I know there's other full-service Rotax centers that offer training in how to maintain your ultralight, your engines.
If I'm not mistaken, I think the Carpenters have the only certified light sport repairman course in the country, don't they? I believe so. The full course.
I don't know if that's... It used to be, and I just don't know if that's true anymore, but I know it used to be.
Yeah, I've interviewed a couple of people who have gone through that course, and it's a phenomenal course from what I understand. I also believe, I'm not sure about this, maybe you guys know, that once you attain your light sport repairman certificate, I think that qualifies you then for a very short move on to the AMP license.
Not that I've ever heard. I do not believe that so. Remember, it's only a 16-hour course. Now, what you're referring to, the
long course,
the 120 hours, I have not taken that, and so I really don't know about that. Do you know, Steve?
No. Huh, okay. Anyway, so let's get back to you had a little bit of everything. You had
right.
You had prairie, you had mountains, and then you had the Midwest.
Yep.
Humidity, heat, but you have all that wind in your face.
It was great. It was just great. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing for me to be flying out in the open. Yeah, I love it.
I guess if you had to compare it to someone who doesn't really know that experience, I guess it would be like an airborne motorcycle ride across the
country.
Right.
It's the difference between flying in a car and on a motorcycle. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. Did you have any excitement on the trip?
We started out with four of us, and one person had some engine difficulties in Wyoming and was not able to land successfully. He was unhurt. But his plane was not unhurt, and so we had to spend some time breaking it down and putting it into a U-Haul truck so he could take it home. But other than that, I was really nervous about flying through Wyoming because of the winds and the altitudes, and it was actually pretty benign. I mean, we actually had more wind going over the Blue Mountains coming out of Oregon than we had in Wyoming. The wind we had was great tailwind. We had sometimes up to 30-mile-an-hour tailwinds. I was seeing like at times 90 to 100 miles an hour over the ground, but there was not turbulence, and that's what I had been really worried about.
Let's talk a little bit about turbulence in an ultralight, because it can be very irritating, not unsafe, but irritating in a regular general aviation airplane, no less a light sport. They're pretty kitey, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And when you say irritating, that's such a, for me and my what I fly, it's such an understatement. Turbulence can be really terrifying. Definitely goes beyond irritating.
Yeah. Now, I would guess that do a lot of thermaling, though, can't you, in these aircraft?
You can, although they're not really gliders. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we did coming across Wyoming, trying if we were having difficulty climbing, was we looked for cloud shadows. And as soon as you get into the cloud shadows, you usually gain several hundred feet of lift, what I call free lift. So when I was having troubles maintaining altitude, I was looking for cloud shadows.
Yep, and summertime. Wintertime, not so much.
That's correct.
Speaking of wintertime, do you fly your airplane in the winter at all?
Well, Oregon, I'm in western Oregon. It rains a lot, and so whenever it's not raining or snowing, I'm flying. Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break once again here at the bottom of the hour, and when we come back, we'll do some more chatting about ultralights. We are down on the forum. I'm Jay Montgomery. We're on the fly.